Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Feature. I'm your host, Tom Majure, and today we're going to talk about invasive species. We're going to talk about them with an expert on the subject, Mark Gaydon. He's with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. He's the Deputy Executive Secretary. Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio, Dr. Mark.
Thank you for having me back. I enjoyed the first conversation, so I look forward to talking more.
It was a delightful conversation, and it is archived in this last year, 2023, on Strong Tower Radio. You can get to that by str.fm and go to Archive Autos under Strong Tower Radio, STR Features, and get the original story. So, Mark, invasive species, just a quick overview. Invasive means it's not domestic, not where it doesn't belong here, and it's been brought here, migrated, or imported by something.
Yeah, the Great Lakes are a tremendous resource, large 20% of the world's fresh water, and you'd think that sort of new species in the system wouldn't have much of an effect, but they do. There are hundreds of species that are native to the Great Lakes, and they are kind of in this, you know, naturally before invasive species in this great dance of predator-prey that is characteristic of the natural world there. And, you know, there's a delicate balance there of nature. And when new species come into a system and make the Great Lakes home, they can have a tremendous negative impact on the whole system. And we've seen that in the Great Lakes Basin over time, particularly since the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway for ships coming into it, but really since the time of settlement of the region and certainly industrialization and when the region became open to the world for trade and commerce and human settlement. Well, invasive species, they remain really one of the biggest problems that we face in protecting and sustaining these wonderful treasures that give so much back to us.
Wow, we've got a lot to talk about in today's program here on Strong Tower Radio Feature. Let's pause for a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you for the world that you have created. Even though it has been degraded by sin and some of our activities, Lord, it still is a beautiful place. Help us to be good stewards of this resource that we have, and be with us and our listeners as we explore this subject. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Mark, we just give a quick overview, whet the taste of what we talked about last time about the sea lampreys, just a couple minutes, and then we'll talk about who was before them and who was after them.
Yep. We focused on the lamprey in our last conversation. This is one of the most obvious and probably difficult invasive species that we've dealt with in the Great Lakes. The lampreys swam their way in through shipping canals, first Lake Ontario in the mid-1800s, and then they made it past Niagara Falls about 1920 and had infested the entire Great Lakes system by 1939. This is an invasive species that has no predator in the Great Lakes. So once they made the Great Lakes home, they were able to wreak pretty destructive havoc on the system. But the lamprey is one of about 180 non-native species that have made the Great Lakes home over time. They happen to be one of the worst of the invasive species, and they also happen to be one of the very, very few that we can keep under control. But nevertheless, the lamprey is far from alone in being the only invader that has come into the Great Lakes and caused considerable harm to the system.
One of the things I remember from that first broadcast is that the lamprey caused such a remarkable problem that governments and industry and maybe sports fishermen that at one time didn't play well together all said, hey, we got to work together. And it actually helped with organizations like the Great Lakes Fishery Commission to become active and to address the issue. And you said very positively, when we are actively involved. During COVID, the efficacy was dropped off because the system had kind of been paused for a moment and it bounced back a bit, but it's a treatable situation.
The lamprey is, unfortunately. Most of the others are not, but yes, we have a large system that is shared by the United States and Canada. And then if you break it down even further, 8 states, the province of Ontario, tribal governments, all of those entities are involved in fisheries, in Great Lakes management in one way or another. And in the early days, this was before we started a lamprey control program in the 1950s. Before that, everybody was trying to do their own thing, and it was leading to an ineffective response. The lamprey were just running wild over the fishery. They were taking more than the commercial catch by a long shot. So something needed to be done. And in kind of the perverse way outcome, lamprey had this way of uniting Canada and the United States against a common threat to the Great Lakes. We put our minds together and developed ways to keep them under control. And we've been able to reduce the lamprey populations by about 95%. Now, the flip side of that is of the 180 some non-native species that we have in the Great Lakes, we actually can control only 2 of them. We can control the lamprey through the control methods that I talked about on the previous program. And we can control a species called the alewife. That's a herring-like non-native species that is controlled by the stocking of predator fish like trout and salmon that love to munch them up. But otherwise, before the big stocking programs emerged in the 1960s, the alewives would die off by the hundreds of millions on Great Lakes beaches. And some of the listeners who remember those days probably remember that those fish would be kind of dead, stinking masses, windrows of these masses on the beaches that had to be buried with backhoes. They were just so voluminous, the alewife. That was a very nasty invasive species that, again, is dealt with by stocking fish, but that's about it. Otherwise, they make more of themselves. They spread, reproduce, and invasive species become a permanent problem in the system.
So with that in mind, you said the lampreys were not the first and the last. One thing we might want to pause, we're radio, so we have to explain things. The lamprey on our website, or newsletter and such, I found a picture of a nice-sized game fish, or it means a fish that a person, that if they ate fish, this would be a desirable fish, maybe 12, 14, 16 inches long. And this one happened to have 2 lampreys, looked like eels, that kind of had attached themselves to this fish. So that's the lamprey. What came before it, and what are we fighting right now?
Well, non-native species are in the entry into the Great Lakes are about as old as settlement of the region. So from the days that humans moved in and started to inhabit the Great Lakes region, they would bring, like the European settlers, a little piece of home with them. So some of the earliest non-native species that we have were actually intentionally introduced, like some carp that we see, like common carp that we have in the Great Lakes, and brown trout, a very popular species in Europe, for example, very good in the Great Lakes. So not all non-native species came in accidentally, and some of them even were brought in to create new fishing opportunities in the Great Lakes, like some of the trout species or steelhead, a very popular species. It's the ones that get in unintentionally, accidentally, and spread without any benefit to the system, in fact, often causing negatives to the system, that we're most concerned about. But those are some of the earliest non-native species that we saw, and many of those were brought in intentionally. Some of the more non-intentional ones might be releases from aquariums, goldfish, They're in the Great Lakes. They can grow very, very large, actually, once they get out and swim about. And alewife that I mentioned, those are some of the earliest invaders that we saw in the system.
So what is on the agenda right now? What's on the front line that's on trending, if the term is correctly used right now?
Well, the way that invasive species policy is carried out is that you look at the vectors, in other words, the pathways for the invaders, and then you find a way to deal with it. We don't have many control techniques in our arsenal once they get into the system, so the focus is on prevention. Prevention from entering the system in the first place, and then preventing the spread. We do have some natural defenses that have been breached, and that's the problem. So around the Niagara region, of course, the Niagara Falls and the Niagara Escarpment is a natural barrier and a buffer from between the Great Lakes and the Atlantic Ocean. But that got busted through with the Welland Canal. There's a long distance between Lake Ontario and the Atlantic Ocean through the St. Lawrence. That got bypassed by the Erie Canal, which connects the Hudson River to upstate New York, connects to the Finger Lakes of New York, and then into Lake Ontario and then Lake Erie. And then there's a natural subcontinental divide that essentially runs through the city of Chicago that separates the Great Lakes Basin from the Mississippi River Basin. That got breached in the late 1800s when they built the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal, which was the reversal of the Chicago River to send sewage and waste down towards St. Louis instead of back into Lake Michigan. But it also now, as the waterways get cleaned up, become a pathway for invasive species. And that's what invasive species policy is all about. You look at how do they get here, and what can you do to stop that from happening?
You know, there's a couple things that you mentioned. One is the term basin. What is the definition of a basin?
If you think about where a drop of water falls, if it falls within the Great Lakes Basin, then it stays in, it's in the Great Lakes Basin. If it falls outside of the basin, it's in a different watershed. And a basin is basically the divide between a watershed. So a drop of water that falls, you know, like near Lake Michigan is going to be in the Great Lakes Basin. If it falls outside of the city of Chicago, it's going to be in the Mississippi River Basin. It's where it ultimately ends up. So something in the Mississippi Basin, that drop of water will hit the Mississippi River and eventually make its way, say, to the Gulf of Mexico. In the Great Lakes Basin, it would be in the lakes and eventually make its way out to the Atlantic Ocean through the St. Lawrence. But it's a watershed divide.
Okay. That was a very clear definition. Is which way does the drop of water go is yeah. The basin. the something that I've heard for, you know, even in my youth, I've heard the term the Chicago Sanitary Canal. That just doesn't sound like a river to me. How can you reverse a river? That's quite amazing. I've always wondered about that.
Well, you know, that it's interesting. So back in the late 1800s, by the late 1800s, Chicago was a pretty filthy, disgusting place. It was the slaughterhouse of the United States. It was the crossroads, rail crossroads. So any, you know, things were shipped in and out. And there was a lot of meat packing and an industry in Chicago.
And that stuff was just dumped into the river.
It's just dumped in the river. And Bubbly Creek is not named, it's a river in Chicago, not named because it's got the natural effervescence of mineral water. It's because all of the waste and offal that they would throw into that system would literally ferment and just kind of bubble up. It was just a very nasty place by all accounts. Well, the Chicago River is a natural river, and it hugs the shoreline of Lake Michigan. Because, and it's not a very long river, because there is a subcontinental divide that separates the Great Lakes watershed from the Mississippi River watershed. And the Chicago River originates a little bit north of the city of Chicago, hugs that subcontinental divide, and then goes through the city of Chicago out into Lake Michigan. The problem was, is back in the day, every nasty thing that they did in Chicago, produced there, was dumped in, as you said, right into the Chicago River, which went out into Lake Michigan. What was the source of drinking water? Lake Michigan. Lots and lots of people got sick by the late 1800s, and the solution was to blast through that subcontinental divide and thus reversing the flow of the Chicago River. Instead of going into Lake Michigan, the Chicago River was diverted into the Mississippi, first the Illinois River, and then the Mississippi River watershed. And the idea was, instead of sending the waste out into Lake Michigan, they just flush it down towards St. Louis. Problem solved. Now, fast forward, you know, a century or more, and with clean water regulations and cleanup environmental pollution efforts that have been wildly successful, that diversion of the Chicago River connection to the Mississippi River watershed is a pathway for invasive species, not just from the Great Lakes to the Mississippi, because there are species that they don't have that we do that they don't want, but it's also a pathway from the Mississippi system into the Great Lakes of unwanted species. And that's how the Asian carp are threatening the lakes. They're in the Mississippi system, and they're threatening the Great Lakes through that Chicago canal.
That's very interesting. There's two things. You said a natural barrier, which you mentioned was Niagara Falls. There was also this natural barrier because of the continental divide, which way does the drop of water flow? And it sounded like there was an elevation that was blasted through, and the water went, you know, really anybody up here in the north who played with streams or played, you know, in the spring when the snow melts and you trying to drain your driveway or drain whatever, just playing in the mud puddles and stuff, you do that same. You divert and try to make water go a direction it's not normally going to go. It was so interesting when you said, I think what I heard you say was the pollution was so bad, the invasive species could not penetrate it. And so the pollution was a barrier, but,
yes.
but it had its own counter effects.
But we found that all over the Great Lakes though, I hate to say this, but you know, we had invasive species in the Great Lakes throughout the 20th century that would come in, and there were some places that were just too polluted to be a suitable home for these invasive species. But, you know, of course, that applied to the native species as well. But that did serve as a buffer to the spread of invasive species in the days before we really got down to business and worked on Great Lakes cleanup. That didn't start until the late 60s or 70s, after a few rivers burned and we became acutely aware of what we were doing to the Great Lakes. But as the system cleaned up and as water quality improved and as fish habitat became more and more abundant with the investments we made in pollution control, the Great Lakes did become a more hospitable place for a wider variety of invasive species. That's the irony of it all. It's good for native fish, but it's also very good for opportunistic fish, too.
Talk about opportunistic fish. Let's talk about that Asian carp. Now, I have personally seen, you heard about it, and it has some, the concern spreads rapidly. The stories about him are quite amazing, but a number of years ago, I was in that watershed, I guess it would have been the Mississippi. It was in the Fox River Valley. I don't know which way that flows, but in Illinois, and I saw an Asian carp for the very first time. To see these quite large fish jumping out of the water, and it's nothing I'd ever seen before. I'm going to let you help better describe it, because you probably know Asian carps better than I do.
Well, do you remember I mentioned a few minutes ago that invasive species policy, you look at the pathways, and that's, you have to know, how do they get here? How did these species get to North America in the first place? And then how do they spread around the continent? That's some of the big concern. These carps were brought in to North America in the 70s, and they were brought in for a very good reason, actually, and that was to keep aquaculture facilities clean. So just like you might throw a sucker into your fish tank so that it eats up the algae, these carps are very good algae eaters. And they would be put into a fish farm, and it's an eco-friendly way to keep that fish farm nice and clean. It's not different even today, where you might have a subdivision or a golf course where these fish are put into it to keep the, you know, the pond free of aquatic weeds or plankton that otherwise itself would be quite a nuisance. So fish farmers, like, these are people who are raising fish for food or for whatever purpose in the deep south, brought the fish in the 70s, and they were doing their job. The thing about fish farms is that they tend to be located near bodies of water, because you need lots of water for it. So you have a fish farm next to a river, and the river floods out the fish farm. Suddenly a escape route for anything that's in that fish farm. And that's how the carps got out into the wild. And they've been making their way, these are big floods in the 70s, 80s. They've been making their way northward ever since. These are big fish. They can grow to very big sizes. I mean, if anybody who's listening, it fish the Great Lakes and they catch a carp, like a common carp, you get a sense of just how big a common carp could get. These can grow even bigger, and they eat a lot, and they reproduce like mad. They're not picky about where they spawn. They're not picky about what they eat, and they've been making their way towards the Great Lakes ever since. One species in particular, the silver carp, are very skittish. The sound of a boat engine is enough to spook them out of the water. And those are the ones you'll see on YouTube that, leap out, and they call them the flying fish. But they, they can be pretty hazardous as well. If you're a boater and you're cruising along and one of these things leaps out at you, not a very pleasant experience, I should imagine, to get hit by a 20, 30-pound fish when you're cruising along. So they can be dangerous as well.
What is the state of the Great Lakes, the balance between the invasive species? Are we winning, holding the battle, or giving up some ground?
I think that we are slowly gaining ground on the invasive species in the Great Lakes, because of the fact that particularly since the zebra mussel invasion of the 1980s, we've had a much better understanding of how these species are getting here and why we need to take action to stop the spread. You'd think we would have learned the lesson with the lamprey, but we didn't. The real latest wave of invasion started in the late 1950s with the St. Lawrence Seaway. And then as globalization increased in the 1980s and the 1990s, we started seeing a real influx of invasive species. It seemed like one after another, like two or three new ones a year. So policymakers, particularly with the zebra mussels, which was first seen in the late 80s in Lake St. Clair and spread very quickly throughout the system, the policymakers listened. Congress listened. Parliament listened. And we started getting a better sense of what we were truly losing. These are amazing gifts, the Great Lakes, that we have, and the havoc that these species were wreaking on the system, to the native species here, to the people who benefit on the lakes, was becoming more and more apparent. And slowly we started seeing measures taken, for example, to stop the movement of invasive species through ships. Ships take on ballast water, and they could sometimes have aquatic hitchhikers in that ballast water. We've seen the fishery managers take more action on stopping the movement through bait, like fish bait. You could have little critters in your bait buckets. We've seen more education so that people who are boating and taking a boat between basins are more aware of what's at stake. And we're trying to close the pathways like the Chicago waterway, not have it be a straight shot into Lake Michigan, but instead have some invasive species barriers there that can be put in place while still not inhibiting the commerce that occurs. It's one step at a time, and it's not cheap, but it's we're certainly not scratching our heads wondering how they're getting here. And I think we're taking steps to slow, if not eliminate, the spread. But the problem is once they're here, you're not going to get rid of them. So you got to keep them out in the first place. And that, I don't think, we're fully there yet.
One last thing in the last couple minutes of our program. Remind our listeners what your organization is and what's its the scope of it. How many dollars do you control, and how do you make the Great Lakes fish population and the sports fishermen and the experience of our communities that delicate balance? How do you do it?
Well, Canada and the U.S. share the Great Lakes, and they share a fishery. And the Great Lakes Fishery Commission is set up by a treaty between the U.S. and Canada. And this was back in 1954. And the two countries made some commitments to each other about how the fishery should be managed and what commitments the two countries would make to cooperate to fulfill the full benefits that the fishery could provide to people. One of the things in the treaty is that lamprey control program, because it was just that big of a deal. But the Fishery Commission also has the responsibility to conduct and organize fishery science so that fishery managers who need to make decisions about things like where to stock fish or how much harvest should happen, have good information upon which to base their decisions. We also have the, I would call the very boring, but also very, very important role of helping the jurisdictions work together. And that's to make sure that Michigan and Wisconsin or Michigan and Illinois are on the same page when it comes to their fishery policies, because it doesn't make a lot of sense for Michigan to do something with respect to the fishery and have Wisconsin do the opposite. We had too much of that chaos in the past. So we want to make sure that they are marching in the same direction, and that's part of the Fishery Commission's responsibility. But it's a $7 billion fishery, and our job is to make sure that steps are taken to sustain that in perpetuity. Invasive species cause some of the biggest threats to that $7 billion fishery, so we're very involved in that policy area.
Well, Dr. Mark, I really appreciate you sharing this subject. These lakes are very precious to us. Sometimes we underappreciate them, but I appreciate your perspective and for us to understand better what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, thank you so much for having me back, and I always enjoy talking with you. Thanks again.
You've been listening to Dr. Mark Gaydon. He's Deputy Executive Secretary of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, which helps us coordinate our policy to have the best possible aquatic environment that we have, that we enjoy here in the Great Lakes State. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, for Strong Tower Radio Feature. Bye now.